Welcome to the Deep Dive, your essential shortcut to being well-informed. I'm Alex Vanderbilt, your guide for today, ready to uncover the most important nuggets of knowledge from the world's most critical publications.
And I'm Sam Astor, here to help you connect those dots, synthesize diverse insights, and understand not just what's happening, but why it truly matters. We're about to explore some fascinating material.
Today, we're taking a deep dive into the Wall Street Journal for Friday, August 29th, 2025.
Right.
We've got a dense stack of articles covering everything from high-stakes political battles in Washington to global geopolitical shifts, economic forecasts, fascinating business innovations, and even some unique cultural and lifestyle pieces.
It's quite a mix today.
It really is. Our mission, as always, is to navigate the sea of information, extract the most crucial insights, and deliver those aha moments that make you truly well-informed. Let's jump right in. Okay, so our journey begins right in the thick of it with an unprecedented legal battle. It's really testing the very independence of a cornerstone U.S. institution. The headline reads, Fed Governor Cook sues to stop Trump from firing her.
Wow.
Okay.
Yeah, this isn't just, you know, a personnel dispute. It feels like a foundational legal challenge. It could redefine the boundaries of presidential power over the Federal Reserve's independent board.
It's huge.
So Federal Reserve Governor Lisa Cook has sued President Trump to block her removal. This comes after Trump cited allegations of fraudulent mortgage applications.
Right. And those were publicized by Bill Polt, who's a Trump appointee leading the Federal Housing Finance Agency, the FHFA.
Exactly. But Cook, crucially, denies these charges, and she hasn't been prosecuted for them.
Right. That's a key point. This case really transcends the individual, doesn't it? It touches on the very design of our economic institutions.
How so?
Well, Cook's lawsuit, filed in Washington, D.C. Federal District Court, argues that governors can only be removed for cause.
Right, for cause.
Which means, you know, proven misconduct, inefficiency, or neglect of duty. And her argument is that an unsubstantiated allegation simply doesn't meet that bar.
Okay.
The lawsuit also names Fed Chairman Jerome Powell and the entire Fed board. It seeks to prevent them from, well, complying with Trump's order.
So they're asking for a temporary restraining order?
They are. A hearing is actually set for Friday morning before Judge Giacobbe, who's a Biden appointee. And look, this is almost certain to reach the Supreme Court.
You think so?
Definitely. Especially given their recent suggestion that Fed employees might enjoy unique protections. They sort of view the central bank as a uniquely structured quasi-private entity.
Interesting phrasing.
It is. And it's all about safeguarding the central bank's ability to act free from political pressure, right?
Yeah.
That principle is just essential for economic stability.
The stakes here couldn't be higher, really. No president has ever attempted to remove a Fed governor before. So this will set a major legal precedent, whatever happens. It forces us to ask critical questions about the Fed's insulation from political influence, especially considering President Trump's past criticisms of Powell and, you know, interest rate policies.
Absolutely.
What's perhaps most surprising, though, is the market's initial reaction. It seemed largely muted.
It was, yeah. Just a minimal and temporary rise in Treasury yields.
So what does that signal? Does it mean markets believe this challenge won't escalate too far? Or are they maybe underestimating the long-term implications of such a direct attack on Fed independence?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a crucial point, and it leaves us wondering whether the market is truly confident or perhaps a bit complacent about the broader ramifications.
Right.
And beyond the legal battle, Cook's uncertain status directly complicates the upcoming Fed meeting. That's September 16, 17.
Where they're supposed to discuss rate cuts.
Exactly, which Chairman Powell had previously hinted at. Now, we've seen tariffs keep inflation above the Fed's 2% target, but Powell has suggested he sees these tariff-driven price increases as temporary, you know, not a long-term inflationary trend.
Okay.
Meanwhile, just hours after an early August Labor Department report sharply cut job growth estimates, President Trump fired the commissioner of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the BLS.
Right. Which leads us directly to another front in this administration's institutional push.
Precisely.
So these high-stakes political battles over appointments could directly affect the stability of economic institutions and, in turn, influence future interest rates, impacting your loans and your investments.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's pivot from the Fed to another critical institution facing intense political pressure, the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Yeah, this is another big one.
Our next deep dive combines inside the Trump administration's vaccine politics with Senate Republicans express alarm over CDC director's firing. There's a real crisis unfolding at the CDC under Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s leadership.
Right.
We've seen the swift firing of CDC Director Susan Monterez.
After just 3 weeks.
Unbelievable. Followed by the subsequent resignations of top officials like Dr. Deborah Howery, Dr. Demeter Daskalakis, and Dr. Daniel Jernigan.
That's a lot of top talent walking out the door.
It is. And this turmoil seems deeply intertwined with the Trump administration's, let's say, fraught vaccine politics and Secretary Kennedy's widely discredited theories linking vaccines to autism.
Yeah, theories that have been thoroughly debunked by science.
And even Senate Republicans, including Senator Bill Cassidy, who is actually a key Kennedy supporter, are expressing alarm now.
The dynamic here is quite revealing, isn't it? President Trump privately seems to view the COVID-19 vaccine program, Operation Warp Speed, as a major accomplishment.
Which objectively it was in terms of speed.
Right. Yet publicly, he often embraces and, well, panders to anti-vaccine supporters. He even expressed interest in Kennedy's unsubstantiated findings.
So the crisis at the CDC reached a boiling point when Monterez was fired. Why exactly?
Well, apparently for refusing to dismiss senior leaders and, crucially, for refusing to just rubber stamp vaccine recommendations that prioritize perceived risks over actual disease prevention.
Wow.
The departing officials have been explicit. They're stating that the agency's integrity has been compromised by placing ideology over scientific consensus.
And under Kennedy's influence, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, the ACIP.
Yeah, all its members were ousted and replaced with vaccine critics earlier this year.
Right. And as a direct consequence, the CDC dropped recommendations for healthy children and pregnant women to get coronavirus shots.
And the FDA narrowed its approval for new COVID booster shots.
This situation poses a profound question, doesn't it? What does it mean for public trust in health recommendations, especially as we head into respiratory illness season?
It's deeply concerning.
The consequences of these departures are severe. We're talking decades of institutional knowledge just walking out the door.
Mm-hmm.
And CDC staff, incredibly, have learned of guideline changes, not from agency experts, but through social media or opinion articles.
That's just staggering.
Yeah.
It undermines the entire process.
Senator Bill Cassidy, a Republican from Louisiana, a state greatly affected by health issues, he called for postponing the September 18 ACAP meeting, citing serious allegations about its agenda and scientific process.
And Senator Susan Collins, Republican from Maine, echoed this alarm, calling Monterez highly capable.
Monterez's lawyers claim she was targeted for protecting the public over serving a political agenda.
Which seems plausible given the context. And the acting director now is Jim O'Neill, the deputy HHS secretary.
This shakeup impacts public health guidance, vaccine availability, and critically trust in national health institutions. It directly affects your personal and family health decisions. Now, let's connect this back to the firing of the BLS commissioner we mentioned earlier. There's an opinion piece titled, E.J. Antoni is the Right Man for BLS by Arthur B. Laffer.
Ah, Laffer, okay.
Yes. Yep. He argues that President Trump's nominee for Bureau of Labor Statistics Commissioner, E.J. Antoni, is the ideal choice to restore the agency's credibility.
Which has taken some hits recently.
Exactly. The BLS has indeed been struggling, declining survey responses, issues in its seasonal adjustment and sampling techniques.
And those big data revisions we talked about, cutting hundreds of thousands of previously reported jobs, that shakes confidence.
It does. Laffer highlights Antoni's doctorate in economics, his role as chief economist at the Heritage Foundation, and his expertise in statistical reform. He also notes that even bipartisan academic economists have called for modernization of these statistics agencies.
Okay, so there's a case to be made for reform. But this narrative, when you view it alongside the Fed and CDC events, it reveals a pattern, doesn't it? The administration seems to be exerting influence over these independent data gathering and regulatory bodies.
It raises questions, certainly.
The accuracy of BLS data is absolutely critical. It's what economists, policymakers, investors, it's what everyone relies on for market stability and economic policy decisions.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that this nomination follows the firing of the previous commissioner.
Yeah.
Well, it naturally raises questions about political motivations behind the leadership of statistical agencies.
Right.
You have to ask, what happens to our understanding of the economy when the very data we depend on becomes a point of political contention?
That's a chilling thought.
It is. The reliability of economic data, jobs, inflation figures, it directly impacts everyone's financial planning, market confidence, and your overall understanding of the economy.
It's a critical issue when trust in data becomes politicized. Now let's pivot to the legal counteroffensive. An article titled "The Go-To Lawyer for Trump's Targets" highlights Abby Lowell.
Ah, Abby Lowell.
Veteran defense lawyer.
Yes, and he's become the lawyer of choice for individuals targeted by the Trump administration. This list includes Fed Governor Lisa Cook.
Who we just talked about. New York Attorney General Letitia James. And now even former CDC Director Susan Monterez.
So he's right in the thick of all these battles.
It seems so. Lowell's boutique firm is actively fighting White House actions, carving out quite a specialized niche here.
Lowell's journey here is quite intriguing. He's 73, and he previously represented Trump family members.
Right, I remember that.
So that gives him a kind of intimate understanding of the administration's approach, presumably. Now, his new firm, it's small, 5 lawyers, 3 staffers, is specifically dedicated to taking on the administration. His client roster includes former Homeland Security official Miles Taylor.
Anonymous.
Right. And a whistleblower lawyer. He even successfully challenged Alina Habba's installation as a top U.S. prosecutor in New Jersey.
And the article mentions Letitia James, the New York AG.
Yes. A Democrat brought that civil fraud case against Trump, which was partially gutted on appeal. Now she's under Justice Department investigation herself for alleged civil rights violations and mortgage fraud.
Which Lowell is defending her against.
Correct. And he also represents Justice Department officials improperly fired by Pam Bondi, another Trump appointee.
This really highlights the significant lawfare, that weaponization of the legal system, that seems to be defining the current U.S. political sphere, right? Legal battles are becoming a central arena for political conflict.
Absolutely. It paints a picture of intense legal maneuvering on all sides.
This article truly gives us a sense of the sheer volume of legal challenges and investigations that are a defining feature of this political moment. It illustrates the specialized and often resource-intensive legal defense required for individuals facing administration scrutiny.
It seems exhausting, frankly.
It does. It's almost as if defending against these probes has become a full-time job for some. It offers you insight into a political climate where legal actions are a prominent tool, potentially affecting public figures and the very institutions you interact with daily.
Okay, let's transition now to the direct economic impact on your wallet. We're looking at higher prices are coming for household staples.
Yeah. U.S. companies like Hormel Foods, J.M. Smucker, Ace Hardware, they're forecasting and implementing price increases for consumers on everyday household staples.
And the reasons.
Rising input costs and, crucially, President Trump's tariffs.
Right. The tariffs again.
And it's not just them saying it. Major retailers like Walmart, Target, Best Buy, they confirm these tariff-related increases are already here, with more on the way.
This is a direct consequence that everyone will feel, isn't it?
Hmm.
The article highlights how beef prices, for instance, have already doubled for some consumers, according to one person quoted.
Yeah, James Paternoster in Queens, New York.
Right. And companies which initially tried to absorb these rising costs or, you know, find other ways to remain competitive, they're now at a point where they have to pass these increases on.
So Hormel Foods raising prices because of beef, pork, nuts.
Tyson Foods, their beef, chicken, pork prices up about 4%. Even restaurant chains like Texas Roadhouse and Portillo's are hiking menu prices because beef is pricier.
It's really widespread.
It underscores the breadth of this inflationary pressure.
This makes you wonder, how much pain are consumers willing to absorb? And how does this feed back into the broader economic picture? We're seeing companies trying to walk a very fine line here.
Definitely. And the consumer response seems mixed. Some show resilience, maybe gravitating to new products or premium brands like Dick's Sporting Goods observed.
Right.
Yet others, particularly middle and lower income shoppers, maybe at places like Walmart, are pulling back on purchases.
But then you have Victoria's Secret, Williams-Sonoma, Dollar General reporting higher sales. How does that work?
Well, partly by being able to charge higher prices or offer fewer discounts, apparently. Dollar General, for example, is trying to mitigate the tariff impact by shifting production or offering smaller pack sizes.
Ah, the old shrinkflation tactic, potentially.
Could be part of it. This signals a new round of sticker shock for consumers, potentially offsetting any recent easing of inflation. It serves as direct evidence of how trade policy trickles down to American shoppers.
And it directly impacts your grocery bill, your household budget, influencing your purchasing decisions and your overall cost of living.
No question.
Okay, but despite those rising prices, we have some, well, surprising economic news. From U.S. economy grew faster in second quarter, new estimate shows, and S&P 500 notches another record after GDP revision.
Yeah, this adds another layer of complexity.
The U.S. economy actually grew at a faster pace than previously estimated in the second quarter. It expanded at an annual rate of 3.3%, up from an initial 3%.
And what drove that?
Largely healthy consumer spending and significant investment in the booming artificial intelligence, or AI, sector.
Ah, the AI effect.
And in response, the S&P 500 hit a new record high.
So this presents a more nuanced economic picture. The Commerce Department's updated estimate shows that a drop in imported goods,
which was likely due to companies front-loading purchases because of tariffs.
Exactly. That actually helped boost GDP. There were also upward revisions in areas like intellectual property, light trucks, commercial, and healthcare structures.
So even though the first half annualized GDP average of 1.4% is a slowdown from 2.5% in 2024.
Right, but final sales to private domestic purchasers rose by a healthy 1.9%. And crucially, software investment grew at its fastest quarterly rate since at least 2007. The article explicitly calls it an AI-related boom.
So we have tariffs pushing prices up, but a surprising bump in GDP, especially driven by AI. It's almost a tale of two economies, isn't it?
It really seems that way.
The market certainly reacted positively. The S&P 500 rose 0.3% to 6,501.86, its 20th record close of the year.
NASDAQ up 0.5%, Dow up 0.2%. Pretty solid.
And the 10-year Treasury yield ticked down slightly to 4.206%.
This stronger GDP figure could certainly influence the Fed's decisions on interest rate cuts, especially with the upcoming PCE index release.
Yeah, it highlights the economy's underlying strength despite tariff concerns and stock market volatility, with AI playing an increasingly significant role in growth.
Yeah.
This provides you a clearer picture of current economic health, affecting job security, investment outlook, and inflationary expectations.
It's a complex mix right now.
Now, for a story about infrastructure, or maybe the glaring lack of it, let's turn to Amtrak's new Acela trains are here. They're moving slower than the old ones.
Wait, slower? How did that happen?
It's quite the paradox, isn't it? Amtrak's new next-generation Acela trains, part of a huge $2.45 billion upgrade, are actually moving slower than the older models they're replacing, and the culprit, the railroad's aging. Over 100-year-old infrastructure along the Northeast Corridor.
Wow. That highlights a crucial disconnect, doesn't it? Investing in cutting-edge technology versus the underlying infrastructure required to actually leverage it.
It feels like a classic example.
It really is. Progress isn't always linear, and sometimes the biggest hurdles are the oldest ones. So Amtrak plans to phase in 28 new high-speed train sets from Alstom over 2 years, replacing 15 older Acela trains.
And they hold more people.
Yeah. Each new train holds 386 passengers, a 27% increase. But while Amtrak's press release touted all the exciting new features, spacious seating, Wi-Fi, power outlets,
they sort of forgot to mention the travel time.
Conspicuously omitted, yes. Amtrak acknowledges that infrastructure upgrades are planned, but only for coming years, to improve speed and reliability.
And ridership is up.
Yeah, ridership in the Northeast Corridor has already recovered beyond 2019 levels, so the demand is clearly there. But the full potential of this massive investment in new trains is being held back by the very tracks they run on.
So passengers get new amenities, but no speed improvement. That could lead to some frustration, despite the big investment.
You think so?
It certainly highlights the challenge of modernizing services when foundational infrastructure is outdated. And it affects travel times and experiences for everyone in the Northeast Corridor, illustrating broader issues of national infrastructure investment. #tag Trump administration enforcement and broader strategy. Now, let's turn our attention to international finance and national security. We've got Chinese money launderers are moving billions through U.S. banks.
Okay, this sounds serious.
It is. This article reveals that Chinese money laundering networks are funneling billions of dollars through U.S. banks. This illicit activity is often linked to the illegal drug trade, particularly fentanyl, and it exploits China's strict currency restrictions and a thriving black market for U.S. cash. Treasury's FinCEN is now encouraging banks to look for specific red flags.
The scale of this operation is just staggering. It really illustrates how global financial systems can be exploited for criminal enterprises.
Yeah.
The article suggests the black market for U.S. cash might have driven as much as $312 billion in illicit money flows through financial institutions.
$312 billion.
That's the estimate. Chinese laws restricting the outflow of money are a key driver, pushing Chinese nationals to black market brokers who, in turn, often deal with drug traffickers.
And the Trump administration's focus.
Well, they've made targeting Mexican cartels a top priority. And China's role in the fentanyl trade, both as a producer of precursor chemicals and an emerging money laundering hub, is also a major focus.
The TD Bank example is pretty stark, too.
Yeah, paying over $3 billion after being used by a Chinese network to launder more than $470 million. It underscores the breadth of this problem.
The scale of these illicit flows is a stark reminder of how interconnected global finance is with organized crime. It has direct implications for national security and efforts to combat the opioid crisis.
Absolutely. And banks face significant fines for failing to detect and report these illicit flows. Yet, somewhat paradoxically, the Trump administration has also aimed to reduce anti-money laundering burdens for banks.
That seems contradictory.
It highlights a tension between enforcement and deregulation, impacting financial system integrity and efforts to combat the drug crisis.
Okay, staying with administration enforcement, let's look at ICI's naval base outside Chicago as operations center. The Trump administration is considering using a naval base near Chicago as an immigration and customs enforcement, or ICE, operations center.
Which would escalate enforcement efforts in sanctuary cities, right?
Yeah.
Following similar deployments in D.C. and L.A.
Exactly. Porter's R. Tom Homan confirmed these discussions, indicating a ramp up of federal immigration enforcement.
This move immediately brings to the forefront that longstanding debate about the balance of federal authority versus states' rights, particularly around immigration enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
Viewed more broadly, it seems part of a concerted strategy by the administration to challenge and change local governance that doesn't align with its policies.
And President Trump has specifically focused on Chicago.
Yes, as a target for a crackdown on crime. Previous deployments of federal agents in D.C. and Los Angeles sparked criticism from local Democratic leadership and raised concerns over the use of federal power on American soil.
And the Chicago mayor.
Mayor Brandon Johnson, a progressive, has pushed back. He pointed out that violent crime in Chicago has actually dropped by over 21% since the beginning of the year.
That's significant.
It is. The administration previously sued Illinois and Chicago over their sanctuary laws, though that suit was dismissed in July. Similar suits have been filed against New York City, Los Angeles, and Rochester, New York.
This highlights ongoing tension and legal battles between federal immigration enforcement and local sanctuary policies. It raises civil liberties concerns about using federal power in major U.S. cities and its impact on immigrant communities.
It certainly does. It affects local governance and debates over policing and federal intervention.
Now, let's talk about a significant breach of protocol, it seems, within the intelligence community. The article, Tulsi Gabbard blindsided CIA over revoking clearance of undercover officer, reports that Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard blindsided the CIA.
Oh, so?
By including an undercover senior officer on a list of 37 individuals whose security clearances she stripped. And apparently, this happened without meaningful consultation with the CIA.
Wow, an undercover officer. That's incredibly risky.
It seems so. Most on the list had ties to Russia election interference assessments or had supported Trump's impeachment.
The audacity of this move is truly striking. Gabbard's office delivered the list the evening before its public release on X, formerly Twitter.
Without giving the CIA a heads up.
No input sought, no foreknowledge of the public posting. Gabbard stated she acted on Trump's orders to remove those who weaponized, politicized, manipulated, or leaked classified intelligence.
And the officer involved.
A longtime Russia hand, apparently. Over 20 years in intelligence posts, served on the National Intelligence Council. Revoking a security clearance effectively terminates employment, of course.
Mm-hmm.
This incident clearly eliminates ongoing tension between top U.S. intelligence officials and raises serious concerns about the politicization of intelligence, the potential for exposing covert officers, and the trust within intelligence agencies.
And Trump's reaction.
President Trump himself publicly congratulated Gabbard for finding interesting things.
This isn't just about security clearances, then, is it? It touches on the very foundation of how intelligence agencies operate, the safety of their personnel, and the public's trust in their nonpartisanship.
Absolutely. It's fundamental.
This incident carries echoes of the Valerie Plame affair back in 2003, where a covert officer's identity was revealed. While revealing a covert officer's identity is a felony, the applicability to government disclosure in this context seems unclear.
It's a murky legal area.
This all impacts national security operations, the functioning of intelligence agencies, and the public's perception of political influence within these critical bodies.
Deeply concerning.
Okay, to round out our discussion on political power plays, let's look at the opinion piece. Trump Triples Down on Lawfare by Kimberly A. Strassel.
Okay, Strassel's take on lawfare.
Yes. She argues that President Trump has perfected lawfare, that weaponization of the legal system against political opponents making Democrats' earlier efforts seem almost like child's play.
A strong claim.
She posits that he's using a high volume of investigations with a wider range of targets and accusations.
This raises a critical question about the long-term health of democratic institutions when the legal system becomes a primary tool for political combat, doesn't it? More broadly, it seems to reflect a fundamental shift in how political power is exercised and contested.
How does she frame Trump's approach?
Well, Strassel points out that while Democrats initiated lawfare targeting Trump, his approach is marked by its sheer volume and breadth. The list of Trump administration investigations into political opponents is extensive.
Including figures like Comey, Jack Smith, Brennan.
Right. January 6th, prosecutors, Letitia James, Adam Schiff, even Fed Governor Lisa Cook. Importantly, he's targeting both Republican critics and Democrats, including John Bolton, Miles Taylor, Christopher Krebs.
So broad net.
Very broad. And Strassel notes that Trump isn't just seeking high crimes. He's using more quotidian accusations, lying to the feds, fiddling mortgage documents, mishandling papers.
And using those allegations for leverage.
That's exactly. To pressure targets into enacting his policy preferences, silence critics, remove officials, or revoke privileges. She highlights that Trump openly directs the Justice Department, contradicting his promise to remove it from the political sphere.
How does she define lawfare?
As singling out public broadcasting of accusation and investigation to pressure, threaten, disgrace, force concessions, or require massive financial outlay to defend against.
That suggests an erosion of norms then, the criminalizing of political acts, creating a prosecutorial race to the bottom, risking long-term damage to the political system.
That's the implication. It also raises questions about whether these actions are for legitimate accountability or just political retribution.
This perspective is essential for understanding the current political climate, the challenges to institutional norms, and the potential for legal processes to be used for political ends, affecting public trust in government and justice.
A really important piece to consider.
Okay, moving to the global stage now. We have a stark reminder of ongoing conflicts with Russia's deadliest attack on Kyiv since Trump-Putin summit damages EU building.
Yeah, the timing there is significant.
Russia launched its deadliest attack on Kyiv since the Trump-Putin summit in Alaska. The strikes damaged the EU delegation building and the British Council. And this occurred just a day before Ukrainian delegates were scheduled to meet Trump's team in New York to discuss security guarantees for a peace deal.
The timing and the consistent pattern of Russia undermining diplomatic efforts here are really striking. Russia has repeatedly set back Trump's peace efforts, right? Demurring on a meeting between Putin and Zelensky, rejecting Western plans for security guarantees.
So this attack sends a clear message.
A very clear message about their stance. And European leaders, increasingly frustrated by the ongoing aggression, are now even devising a plan to potentially put troops on the ground in Ukraine to guarantee any peace agreement.
Wow, that's a major step.
It is, though they've met stiff resistance from the Kremlin. Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov, for his part, insists on veto power over peace plan details. Meanwhile, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov claims the strikes were successful and hit targets, yet maintains Russia is still interested in peace talks.
It's hard to square those two things.
It is. This attack, coming right on the heels of the Trump-Putin summit, delivers a very clear message about the state of play in the conflict.
This raises critical questions about the prospects for peace and for Europe's role in securing it. EU officials confirmed damage to their building, but thankfully, staff were safe. UK Prime Minister Starmer condemned the attacks,
saying Putin is killing children and civilians and sabotaging hopes of peace. Strong words.
And President Trump, for his part, had issued a 2-week deadline for Russia and Ukraine to advance peace or face potential U.S. retaliation, ranging from massive sanctions or massive tariffs to potentially doing nothing.
A wide range of possibilities there.
The bombardment lasted over 11 hours, hitting residential areas, which just highlights the ongoing humanitarian costs. Understanding this conflict is crucial for comprehending international diplomacy and global stability.
Absolutely essential.
Next, a significant development in international nuclear diplomacy. Europe moves to reimpose sanctions on Iran for nuclear work, and the accompanying opinion piece, Europe pulls the snapback trigger on Iran.
Okay, the snapback mechanism.
Yes. The UK, France, and Germany have officially triggered it to reimpose all international sanctions on Iran that were lifted under the 2015 nuclear deal.
Which the US left back in 2018.
Correct. Their hope is to pressure Tehran to resume nuclear negotiations with the Trump administration. But this move effectively deals a final death blow to the original 2015 agreement, according to the opinion piece.
This is such a multi-layered challenge, isn't it? You've got the nuclear standoff, the economic leverage, the dynamics of great power competition with Russia and China. It makes you wonder, can sanctions truly compel behavioral change, or do they risk further entrenching the regime?
That's the perpetual question with sanctions.
So European countries cited Iran's broad breaches of the 2015 deal. This decision triggers a 30-day period for the return of UN-backed economic, banking, weapons, and trade sanctions.
Which Russia and China can't block at the UN.
Correct. They can't block the snapback itself. Iran's foreign ministry has called the move unlawful and threatened appropriate responses, potentially halting talks with the UN Atomic Agency, the IAEA.
And we know Iran enriched uranium to 60% purity back in 2021.
Right, and the IAEA has exposed Iran's deception and noncompliance with its safeguards agreement, which is foundational to preventing the spread of nuclear weapons.
Is there any way out of this?
Well, European powers could theoretically delay sanctions if Iran takes swift, tangible action on talks and inspections, especially after U.S. and Israeli strikes damaged those key sites, Fordo, Natanz, Isfahan, back in June.
This development certainly heightens concerns about Iran's nuclear program and the potential for further escalation if Iran withdraws from the Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT.
Which would be a major blow to global non-proliferation efforts.
The direct economic effect on Iran's already struggling economy might be modest, potentially weakening its currency and propelling inflation, particularly since China is unlikely to stop buying Iranian oil.
Right. China's role is key there.
However, it further complicates financial transactions and diplomacy, making a resolution more challenging. The U.S. has reiterated it's still open to a deal if Iran allows on-demand inspections and abandons enrichment.
So the door isn't completely shut, but it's certainly harder to walk through now.
This impacts global energy markets, international security, and the stability of the Middle East, with potential for broader economic and military consequences.
A very tense situation.
Shifting to another volatile region, let's discuss Israeli troops raid site deep inside Syria, Damascus says. This is a significant development. Israeli troops conducted a rare overnight ground raid deep inside Syria near Damascus, backed by airstrikes.
A ground raid deep inside Syria. That is unusual.
Yes. And it occurred amidst ongoing U.S. efforts to end hostilities between the two countries following the fall of the Assad regime late last year. Syrian state media reported at least 6 soldiers killed.
The timing and strategic objectives of this operation are particularly noteworthy. Why now?
Well, the strikes apparently followed Syria's discovery of surveillance and eavesdropping devices. The operation involved 2 nights of airstrikes near a military base in Kiswa, followed by a 3-hour ground raid.
And Israel's official stance?
The Israeli military declined comment, but Defense Minister Israel Katz stated that forces operate in all theaters of battle. Syria and Israel have been in talks over a security arrangement since Assad's ouster in December.
Right, trying to establish some stability there.
But Israel is demanding the demilitarization of the entire border area and expresses distrust of new Syrian leaders' ties to jihadist groups, though Syria claims those ties are severed.
And the U.S. position.
The Trump administration, interestingly, supports the new Syrian government and is working to stabilize its rule.
So this raid complicates those efforts.
It seems likely. A ground raid deep inside Syria is a significant development, especially with all these diplomatic efforts trying to stabilize the region. It's truly a high-stakes chess game.
What do you think Israel's objective was?
Well, likely aiming to boost intelligence capabilities before any security agreement forces its withdrawal. The strikes were also probably intended to prevent intelligence-gathering devices from falling into Syrian hands.
Makes sense.
Since Assad's fall, Israel has launched hundreds of ground incursions and airstrikes, mostly near the border. But this raid near Damascus marks the first publicly known deep ground operation.
So it's an escalation of sorts.
It appears so. This continued military action in a fragile region complicates peace efforts and could lead to wider conflict, underscoring the difficulty of stabilizing post-Assad Syria and securing its borders with Israel. This impacts understanding the complexities of Middle East conflicts, the roles of international actors, and the potential for humanitarian crises.
A very delicate situation.
Finally, in global geopolitics, we have Kim and Putin to join Xi in show of unity at Beijing military parade. This signals a clear strengthening of ties between these nations. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and Russian President Vladimir Putin will join Chinese President Xi Jinping at a Beijing military parade.
While most European leaders and Trump will not attend, that's telling.
It is.
This signals a significant realignment of global powers and what this show of unity means for the international stage. It's a clear indication of a multipolar world taking shape, and it could have substantial impacts on global trade, security, and diplomatic efforts.
What's the occasion for the parade?
It commemorates the 80th anniversary of Japan's World War II defeat, providing China an opportunity to showcase its military might. For Kim Jong-un, it's his first multilateral gathering and first visit to China since 2019, signifying a shift.
Especially since North Korea had been focusing more on ties with Moscow.
Exactly, including sending troops to Ukraine, which had previously strained relations with Beijing. However, relations with Beijing seem to be improving now, offering North Korea additional economic support beyond what Moscow can provide.
But they still disagree on nuclear weapons.
Despite the show of unity, yes. China and North Korea remain divided on nuclear weapons, with Pyongyang rejecting denuclearization.
So this emerging bloc could challenge Western influence and existing global orders?
Potentially, yes. And it certainly raises concerns for South Korea and Japan, particularly regarding North Korea's nuclear ambitions and regional stability. This affects global power dynamics, international trade relations, and the security landscape, particularly in East Asia.
A lot to watch there. Hashtag tag tech tech chat B, international economic outlook. Okay, let's pivot now to international economic outlook, starting with Philippines Central Bank cuts rates again to support economy.
Another rate cut there.
Yes, the third consecutive time. By a quarter of a percentage point, 25 basis points down to 5.00%. This move is aimed at bolstering the economy amidst low inflation, providing crucial room to support growth.
This illustrates how central banks in emerging economies are navigating those global headwinds and domestic pressures we talked about earlier.
So the decision was expected.
Yes, economists anticipated it. The benchmark overnight reverse repurchase rate is now 5.00%, the lending rate 5.50%. This easing is made possible by low inflation. July's print was near a six-year low, and inflation expectations remain well anchored.
What are the forecasts?
Predicting inflation at 1.7% for 2025, 3.3% for 2026, and 3.4% for 2027. However, potential electricity rate adjustments and higher rice tariffs could raise future inflationary pressures.
So more cuts might be coming.
More cuts are expected, partly due to subdued price growth in those persistent tariff worries, even after the Philippines struck a trade deal with the U.S. While domestic demand has held firm, the Monetary Board noted that the impact of U.S. policies on global trade and investment continues to weigh on the outlook.
It prompts you to consider how these national policy decisions, like rate cuts, influence not just the local economy, but also feed into broader global trade dynamics, especially when faced with external pressures like tariffs.
Exactly. It illustrates how global economic factors and trade policies can influence national economic decisions and impact economic growth in various countries, potentially affecting your investments in international markets.
Next, a more concerning economic forecast for a major global player. Eurozone's economic outlook worsens amid U.S. tariffs, domestic pressures.
Yeah, confidence seems to be falling there.
Sluggish growth weighing on sentiment, and apparently it's worsened by new U.S. tariffs and domestic political pressures, like France's potential government collapse.
This just underscores the fragility of global economic interconnectedness. We're observing how tariff battles and internal political instability can quickly sour economic sentiment across an entire continent.
So the European Commission's economic sentiment indicator fell.
Yes, to 95.2 from 95.7 in July, missing expectations for an uptick. Consumer confidence, industry, construction sentiment all declined.
And the U.S. trade deal impact.
That new deal applies a baseline 15% tariff on EU exports, and it's directly hurting exporters, especially in Germany, where the economy actually shrunk 0.3% in the second quarter amid all this tariff turmoil.
and the situation in France.
Minority government there is likely to collapse, and Finance Minister Eric Lombard has even warned of potential recourse to the IMF due to deep-seated fiscal problems.
Wow, the IMF for France.
That's what he mentioned as a possibility.
This shows how global trade policies and political stability in other major economies can have ripple effects, affecting international markets and supply chains. It highlights a direct impact of U.S. trade policies on European economies, and how domestic political issues can exacerbate economic woes, raising the specter of serious economic challenges for major European economies.
It's a worrying trend.
To delve deeper into the fiscal health of some major European economies, let's discuss the opinion piece. Bail out France and Britain. You'll need a bigger IMF. Joseph C. Sternberg dismisses that recent speculation about IMF bailouts for the UK and France.
Okay, so he's pushing back on that idea. Why?
He argues that these economies are simply too large for the IMF to rescue. And more fundamentally, that their problems stem from structural insolvency rather than temporary liquidity crises.
Ah, insolvency versus illiquidity. That's a key distinction. This article really challenges us to consider the true nature of the financial challenges faced by developed nations and the very role of international financial institutions.
So Sternberg highlights that while speculation about IMF bailouts is growing, the UK last had one in 1976, France is newer to this idea.
The sheer scale makes it impractical. The IMF's total lending capacity is about $1 trillion. That's sufficient for countries like Sri Lanka or Pakistan. Greece, remember, received about $32 billion from the IMF as part of a much larger total bailout package.
And British and French debt levels.
British government debt is $2.8 trillion. French debt is $2.7 trillion. Just massive numbers compared to the IMF's capacity.
Because the IMF specializes in liquidity panics.
Exactly. But Britain and France are, according to Sternberg, insolvent. Their future spending commitments, particularly social welfare and old age benefits, far exceed realistic growth estimates. This leads to high premiums for financing deficits and political strains from debt service costs, not a lack of immediate cash.
So this isn't just about the numbers, it's about the political theater and who gets to take the blame for hard decisions, isn't it? What does this all mean for the average citizen in these countries and for the global financial landscape?
Well, Sternberg suggests politicians might be using these IMF threats to force through unpopular spending cuts and reforms, essentially shifting blame to the IMF for painful policy conditions like tax increases and spending cuts.
Making the IMF the scapegoat.
He argues the IMF lacks effective enforcement for better reforms and thus becomes a convenient scapegoat. This highlights deep-seated fiscal issues in major economies, leading to calls for austerity, and reveals how international financial institutions can be leveraged for domestic political ends.
It's essential for understanding sovereign debt, the role of the IMF, and how political leaders frame economic challenges for their citizens.
A very insightful piece on the political economy of bailouts.
Okay, let's transition now to the business world, focusing specifically on retail and consumer spending amidst these tariffs we keep mentioning. We have several articles that paint a vivid picture of how different retailers are navigating these economic headwinds. We'll look at Burlington Stores, Dollar General, Victoria's Secret, Dick's Sporting Goods, and Best Buy.
Right.
The overarching theme seems clear. Companies are wrestling with tariffs and inflation while consumers are becoming increasingly price sensitive, though maybe with some nuanced spending habits.
This section gives us a fantastic real-world look at how trade policy really ripples through the economy, doesn't it? What's particularly striking is that dual challenge retailers face. Managing rising costs, largely due to tariffs, while simultaneously trying to cater to a consumer base that's increasingly discerning about where and how they spend.
So Burlington Stores, for example.
Well, they raised their full-year guidance after a strong second quarter, which sounds good.
Right.
But their caution around tariffs and price-sensitive shoppers suggests deep uncertainty. They expect incremental tariff risk in the fall and anticipate more pressure on merchandise margins in the fourth quarter, despite efforts to offset costs through negotiations and selective price increases.
So optimism tempered with significant caution.
Exactly.
That caution from Burlington is echoed in different ways across the sector. Dollar General, however, offers a really compelling counter-narrative. They seem remarkably adaptable.
How so?
They're attracting shoppers across all income levels and raised their full-year outlook after better-than-expected second-quarter profit and sales.
Even with tariffs?
Yes. CEO Todd Vasos says the company limits price increases and keeps products cheaper than rivals, expecting to offset the vast majority of tariff-related costs. Their same-store sales rose a strong 2.8%, driven by heavier traffic and larger average baskets. It really confirms that trend of consumers prioritizing value.
So they're capturing a wider audience.
It seems so. Meanwhile, Victoria's Secret lifted its full-year sales target after strong growth, but flagged that the impact of tariffs is now expected to be twice as high as previously estimated, coming in at a hefty $100 million.
Ouch. That illustrates how even strong sales growth can be eaten away by external economic pressures,
Right.
directly impacting profitability, especially if they have other costs like acquisitions.
Which they do, mentioning costs from the Adore Me acquisition hitting the third quarter.
Right. Then you have Dick's Sporting Goods. They also lifted their outlook on climbing sales. Their CEO noted that shoppers are gravitating to new products and premium brands and haven't had issues with small price increases.
So that highlights a segment of resilient consumer spending where value and perceived quality allow for some price flexibility.
Precisely. However, their CFO still cited tariff impacts and a promotional environment as challenges for the back half, expecting more pressure on gross margins. It's not all smooth sailing.
No. And finally, Best Buy posted a surprise sales increase in the second quarter. Spending on electronics held up despite price increases to offset tariffs.
That's interesting. Their CEO noted customers are resilient but thoughtful about big-ticket purchases, focusing on value, and that even lower-income customers haven't completely stepped away from spending.
They raised prices on some items in Q1 due to tariffs.
Right. The fact that Best Buy saw increased sales despite raising prices due to tariffs suggests a strong demand for tech innovation. It makes you ask, is it the products themselves or strategic pricing that's helping them navigate these tariff impacts?
It's a good question. So we're seeing a mixed bag, overall strong sales in some areas, but persistent caution about tariffs and margins across the board. It shows that even successful retailers are very sensitive to the current economic environment.
Absolutely.
For you, this means understanding how businesses are adapting to protect their margins, how those tariffs are influencing pricing on everything from your groceries to your electronics, and how your own spending habits are part of a larger, evolving consumer landscape. Now, let's explore the future of technology, starting with a very relatable example. Taco Bell rethinks future of voice AI at the drive-thru.
Ah, the talking drive-through.
Exactly. Taco Bell is reevaluating its approach, coming to the realization that, quote, more artificial intelligence isn't always better. They are now carefully analyzing data from millions of customer orders to determine the optimal deployment.
This is such a crucial reality check for businesses rushing into AI implementation, isn't it? It's not about simply adopting the newest tech, but finding the right balance for efficiency and, critically, customer satisfaction.
So their exact plans are still developing.
Yeah, active internal conversations, discussions with franchisees. It's still a very early stage for voice AI and drive-thrus, not just for Taco Bell, but for other brands too.
It perfectly illustrates the challenges of AI implementation.
Right. It shows that user experience considerations are paramount. This story makes you consider, in the rush to embrace AI, how many businesses might overlook the human element, and what are the long-term consequences of that oversight for customer experience?
So even a massive chain like Taco Bell is learning that just throwing AI at a problem isn't always the solution. It's a reminder that human interaction and user experience are still paramount. This affects your everyday interactions with technology and customer service, as well as the broader discussion around AI's practical integration into daily life.
Well said.
From drive-thrus to garbage day, let's talk about trash pickup's future, self-driving bins, quieter trucks, and hassle-free recycling.
Now, this sounds interesting.
This article details how urban planners, the refuse industry, and cities are reimagining waste management with new technologies. AI, robotics, electric power, all to address a growing garbage crisis in the U.S. Americans, by the way, produce nearly a ton of refuse per person annually.
A ton per person.
Wow. This article presents a fascinating holistic approach to what many see as a mundane but critical urban service. The goals are ambitious: make recycling easier, recover more recyclable materials.
As Javier Logan from the NYC Department of Sanitation emphasizes.
Right. We're talking about innovations like single-stream recycling, where residents put all recyclables in one bin, and then AI-powered cameras and robots sort them at remote facilities. They can even identify hazardous or valuable materials like electronics.
And composting.
Municipalities may mandate in-home containers for curbside composting bins, like New York City has launched.
This sounds like trash pickup straight out of a sci-fi movie. Self-driving bins.
Imagine small, battery-powered robots, like Oshkosh's Harry concept, that could be ordered on demand to pick up trash and offload it to central locations. And these bins could monitor contents, divert improper items, maybe even bill households accordingly.
That's the idea. Plus, electric garbage trucks, like Oshkosh's Volterra ZFL, promise quieter operation, no tailpipe emissions, and a tighter turning radius.
And AI-powered collection arms.
Guided by cameras and sensors. While some suggest enlisting delivery vehicles for efficiency, MIT's Carlo Ratti aptly notes you can't deliver groceries with garbage.
Good point. This vision offers environmental benefits and urban efficiency, but it also raises new questions about data privacy with bins monitoring contents.
That's definitely a consideration.
The future of waste management directly impacts urban living, your environmental footprint, and your daily routines.
A total potential game changer.
Now, shifting gears to the automotive industry, let's discuss China's BYD outsells Tesla in Europe again. This is a significant indicator of changing market dynamics.
Yeah, BYD is making serious inroads.
China's BYD once again outsold Tesla in Europe in July. They tripled their new car registrations year on year, while Tesla's registrations contracted by more than 42%.
More than 42% down for Tesla. That's huge. This clearly signals intense competition from Chinese electric vehicle, or EV makers.
It feels like a major signpost about market dominance and the global shift in the automotive industry.
It really is. More broadly, it's not just about who sells more cars, but about the implications for innovation, manufacturing, and trade relations between continents.
So BYD's registrations across the EU tripled to nearly 9,700 vehicles.
And over 13,500, including the UK and others. In stark contrast, Tesla's registrations in the EU contracted 42% to 6,600 cars. That extends a streak of disappointing EU monthly sales for Tesla. December 2024 was its last growth month there.
And other Chinese car makers are gaining too.
Yes, SAIC Motor also outsold Tesla. They're rapidly gaining market share with their relatively cheap and varied EV lineups. BYD first outsold Tesla in Europe back in April.
And the overall EV market in Europe is growing.
Yes, overall EU passenger car registrations grew 7.4% in July, with battery electric vehicles alone up 39%. So the market is growing, but Tesla's share is shrinking significantly there.
This affects the future of the automotive industry, your choices for electric vehicles, and the broader economic competition between global powers.
Definitely a space to watch closely.
Okay, let's look at the titan of AI chips with even NVIDIA has speed limits. NVIDIA, now the world's only public company with a market cap over $4 trillion.
Just staggering numbers.
Reported another period of record revenue and operating profit. However, its fiscal second quarter sales growth of 56% was its slowest in 2 years, and its outlook was perceived as underwhelming by some.
It's remarkable, isn't it, how even stellar growth can be considered underwhelming for a $4 trillion company? It highlights incredibly high investor expectations.
It reflects the intense scrutiny at the very cutting edge of the tech economy.
And the complex interplay between innovation, market demand, and geopolitical factors. NVIDIA's sales surged 56% from a year earlier, a rate that still vastly exceeds other mega-cap tech companies.
Even with AI chip sales to China effectively shut off.
Right, due to national security concerns. The stock, remarkably, was up 65% since Trump's Liberation Day event back on April 2nd.
But the data center revenue fell short.
Despite record data center segment revenue of $41 billion, it fell slightly short of Wall Street projections, causing a 3% dip in after-hours trading. The outlook remains strong, though. They expect a $7.3 billion revenue increase in the current quarter, driven by demand for its new Blackwell chip family.
But China remains a question mark.
A major question mark. NVIDIA hasn't shipped its H20 chip there yet, awaiting regulations on the Trump administration's demanded 15% cut on AI chip sales to China.
So even the AI kingmaker, NVIDIA, with its incredible growth, has to contend with geopolitical headwinds and growing competition.
Absolutely. It's a fascinating look at the very tip of the tech spear. NVIDIA faces growing competition from rivals like AMD, in-house chips from Amazon and Google, various startups, all while navigating the cost of doing business in a global trade war.
This impacts the future of AI technology, the global tech industry, and investment opportunities in high-growth sectors.
For sure. #C. Financial markets and corporate news.
To conclude our business insights, let's turn to financial markets with TD Bank. CIBC results echo peers, buoyed by lower credit loss provisions.
The Canadian banks.
Yes, Canada's largest lenders, TD Bank and CIBC, posted stronger quarterly earnings, primarily driven by lower provisions for credit losses.
Which reflects a growing optimism about the resilience of their loan books, right? despite continued wariness of trade policies.
Exactly.
This marks a notable shift in how banks are viewing risk. The reduction in credit loss provisions suggests a more positive economic outlook, but it's still tempered by those trade policy concerns. It suggests a kind of cautious optimism in the financial sector.
So the big six Canadian banks saw provisions decline.
Yes. In the fiscal third quarter, after a significant buildup earlier over fears of a recession and tariff threats, TD Bank, for example, swung to a profit of $3.34 billion, or US $2.42 billion, despite a restructuring charge for anti-money laundering controls.
And their credit loss provision fell.
Fell broadly, reflecting what the bank called strong underlying credit performance. CEO Raymond Chun noted that both the Canadian and U.S. economies show resilience, but momentum has slowed and anticipates a long road before the full impact of tariffs is well understood.
And both banks are planning share buybacks.
Yes, which signals confidence.
This affects the stability of the financial system, lending rates, and overall economic confidence, which can impact your personal finances and business opportunities.
Bank performance is often a key indicator.
And as we discussed earlier, the S&P 500 notched another record after GDP revision also contributed to this cautiously optimistic financial picture.
Right. The market's reaction to the revised GDP figures and the banking sector's performance collectively suggest an underlying economic resilience despite those ongoing headwinds.
A complex but maybe slightly more positive picture there. Okay, let's shift now to social trends, beginning with a deeply contentious issue. Another mass shooting in a gun-free zone opinion.
Very difficult topic.
Yes. In this opinion piece, John Arlott Jr. and Thomas Massey argue that the Minneapolis Annunciation Catholic school shooter, like many others, intentionally targeted a gun-free zone to maximize victims. They contend that the media often ignores this crucial motivation, thereby hindering discussions about potentially effective solutions like armed citizens.
This opinion piece directly challenges a common narrative surrounding these tragic events, doesn't it? The authors highlight that the shooter's manifesto explicitly stated choosing gun-free zones like schools, citing Adam Lanza, the Sandy Hook shooter, as his reason.
Right.
They argue that mass shooters seek attention and aim for high victim counts, knowing that places where no one can fight back are ideal targets. The article points out that while the media may focus on a shooter's obsession with school shootings or reverence for other mass shooters, it often omits the shooter's own words about the vulnerability of gun-free zones.
It makes you consider, by focusing on certain aspects of a tragedy while omitting others, is the public being fully informed about the motivations behind these attacks? And does that omission impact the policy solutions we consider?
It's a valid question about media framing.
This opinion piece certainly presents a different perspective on mass shootings. It's a hard conversation, but it's crucial to understand all angles of these tragic events. The authors note that Minnesota already has background checks and red flag laws, yet the shooter still obtained 3 firearms legally.
And the state law banning guns in schools with a 5-year prison penalty clearly didn't deter him.
They state that approximately 60% of these attackers die at the scene, suggesting they aren't deterred by theoretical prison time. They also cite that 92% of mass public shootings occur in gun-free zones, and the Nashville Covenant school shooter admitted to avoiding a site with too much security.
So their proposed solution.
Arming teachers and other employees with concealed firearms, arguing it removes the tactical advantage for attackers. They mention that over 20 states and more than 10,000 public schools already allow armed teachers, with no deaths or injuries other than suicides or gang violence in such schools. Representative Massey is reintroducing the Safe Students Act to repeal the federal Gun-Free School Zones Act.
A very controversial proposal, but one based on their analysis of the problem.
This directly impacts debates on school safety, gun rights, and community protection, shaping policy decisions that affect families and public spaces.
Absolutely.
Next, let's delve into another complex social issue with the letters piece, how cities can get real about homelessness. M. Professor Barry Latzer from John Jay College argues that drug and alcohol addiction, along with mental illness, are the primary drivers of homelessness.
Okay, focusing on addiction and mental illness as the root cause.
Yes, and he proposes costly solutions that include criminal prosecution for serious crimes, involuntary placement of psychotic individuals in hospitals, and mandatory detoxification for addicts.
This piece raises a fundamental question about how society defines and responds to complex social problems. It represents a significant debate about individual responsibility versus systemic issues and the cost of both inaction and intervention.
So Letzer's argument, in response to an earlier op-ed, asserts that most homelessness is due to addiction and mental illness, not merely a housing shortage. He even suggests some individuals may prefer street living.
And his proposed solutions.
Three main points. First, criminal prosecutions for serious crimes, noting that minor offenses like loitering are ineffective without treatment. Second, involuntary placement of psychotic individuals in special wards or hospitals if they are dangerous to themselves or others, citing street living as evidence of self-harm predisposition, and criticizing the closure of mental hospitals in the 1970s.
And third,
involuntary placement in detoxification shelters for addicts, again, based on evidence of self-harm.
These are very assertive, potentially controversial interventions.
Yeah,
they are. And the article also features a counterargument that disputes mental illness and addiction as principally the problem. It points out that 2.5 million housed Californians struggle with addiction, and that the AEI Housing Center's Good Neighbors Index shows higher homeless counts in areas with higher price-to-income ratios, suggesting housing affordability plays a significant role.
So it highlights that fundamental disagreement on the root causes of homelessness, right? Housing first versus treatment first approaches.
Exactly. And regardless of the approach, all effective solutions will be expensive. This piece impacts your understanding of a pressing urban problem, debates over social welfare policies, and the allocation of public resources.
A really tough issue with no easy answers.
No, a fascinating look at immigration policy and its unintended consequences, with the UK tried to clamp down on migration and wound up with an unprecedented wave.
Oh, this sounds like a policy backfire.
A major one. This article details how Britain's post-Brexit visa program, originally intended to attract fewer skilled workers, completely backfired. Instead, it led to the country's largest influx of legal migration ever, a debacle that even drew populist Nigel Farage back into politics.
The irony and the cascade of unintended consequences here are truly striking. Nigel Farage had campaigned for decades for Brexit, specifically to control migration.
Right.
Yet the Tories, despite repeatedly promising lower overall immigration levels, soon lost control of the very system they designed. In just 4 years, 4.5 million people arrived in Britain, primarily from India, Nigeria, and China. That's one in every 25 current residents.
One in 25? That's massive. How did the system allow that?
The new system scrapped the non-EU cap and allowed companies to sponsor an unlimited number of foreign workers, many of whom could bring family members, under a very broad definition of skilled worker. Some industries were even permitted to pay below market rates.
It makes you consider. When governments design policies to address complex issues like migration, how thoroughly do they consider the entire ecosystem of incentives and potential backfiring mechanisms?
Apparently not thoroughly enough in this case.
So, a policy designed to cut immigration actually led to an unprecedented wave, completely changing the social and political landscape. This raises questions for other nations considering similar policies and for the UK's future. The article details dire consequences: massive population growth straining public services like housing and healthcare,
and a slowdown in per capita GDP growth to just bishral 0.3% annually.
Which led to significant political backlash, with Nigel Farage's Reform UK gaining substantial electoral ground.
The care system serves as a stark example. The government allowed companies to sponsor visas for foreign workers at low salaries, leading to nearly 700,000 carers and their families arriving in 4 years. This resulted in widespread fraud and abuse, with many workers trapped in debt or without jobs.
And student visas.
A surge there, too. Universities heavily recruited foreign students for higher fees, but a Home Office study found that over half eventually switched to low-paid care work.
Has the government responded?
They've since tightened student visa eligibility and barred healthcare companies from hiring abroad, but the initial policy's effects are long-lasting.
This highlights the complexities of immigration policy, its economic and social impacts, and its influence on political movements, relevant for understanding national debates and global trends.
A real cautionary tale.
Yeah.
Hashtag, tag, 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 be personal finance and workforce.
Now let's turn to personal finance and the workforce, starting with a crucial issue. Childcare doesn't have to be such a sacrifice, Letters. Jason Resendez from the National Alliance for Caregiving argues that the U.S. desperately needs a stronger national care infrastructure,
including paid leave and affordable childcare.
Exactly. Which he says is essential to support caregivers and unlock the workforce's full potential.
This letter really reveals the hidden costs of our current societal structure, doesn't it? How it impacts individual careers and the broader economy. It's about shifting from a make-it-work mentality to a supportive infrastructure that truly values caregiving.
Resendez illustrates this with the story of Brittany Ivey,
who was forced to leave her career after being denied unpaid leave for her premature twins, and later found that childcare costs would basically negate any earnings from a new job.
It's a story many can relate to, unfortunately. He points out that an estimated 130 million people in the U.S. provide care, whether for children or elderly parents, calling them the backbone of our economy.
Yet they lack basic support. He argues that investing in family policies isn't just a social good. It's an economic imperative to ensure a prosperous future for all. The lack of support forces talented individuals out of the workforce, hindering economic growth.
This directly impacts working parents and caregivers, influencing career choices, financial stability, and overall quality of life.
A really critical point.
Okay, let's tackle the big question about the future of work itself with how will we earn an income in the age of AI? Letters. Professor Stuart Burr from the University of Virginia challenges the common focus on lack of work incentives.
And instead urges a broader debate.
Yes, on how to transition from wage-based income to a system of broad participation in the gains from automation and AI. He even proposes ideas like a universal high income.
This article really highlights how rapidly the technological landscape is forcing us to rethink fundamental economic structures. Burr's argument, in response to a column by Jason L. Riley, posits that if technologists are to be believed, highly capable robots will soon perform most tasks currently done by humans.
Like optimist-like machines designing, building, maintaining houses, farming, cooking.
Right, which inevitably leads to a crucial economic challenge. If machines do most of the work, what jobs remain for people? And, critically, who buys the products if incomes are still tied to traditional employment, which is rapidly diminishing?
The age-old question of how we earn a living is getting a serious update from AI. So what does this all mean for your career, your kids' future, and the very structure of our economy?
Burr suggests we need a plan for this transition, debating how to share productivity gains through mechanisms like a national dividend or broader capital ownership. He points out that Elon Musk has floated the idea of a universal high income, but hasn't really detailed the path to get there.
Burr concludes that simply lamenting a lack of incentives won't prepare us. Planning will.
It raises fundamental questions about the nature of employment and income in an increasingly automated world. It suggests a need for systemic economic restructuring to ensure technological progress benefits everyone.
This directly impacts your long-term career planning, financial security, and societal debates about wealth distribution and the role of work in human life.
Huge questions for the future.
Okay, let's unwind a bit and turn to culture and entertainment. First, a film review for Caught Stealing Review. Austin Butler in New York's Netherworld.
Austin Butler again. He's everywhere.
He is. Kyle Smith reviews Darren Aronofsky's Caught Stealing, describing it as a sordid and often hilarious 1990s set noir starring Butler as Hank, a former baseball hotshot turned bartender who gets thrust into New York's dangerous underworld.
Aronofsky doing noir. Interesting. This film seems to excel at evoking a very specific time and place, capturing those untamed parts of the city that are quickly disappearing. It makes you consider. What role does art play in preserving the memory and atmosphere of bygone eras and challenging our often sanitized perceptions of urban history?
Smith praises Butler's starburst performance as an innocent dupe caught between Russian mobsters and Hasidic hoodlums, all after simply looking after a neighbor's cat.
Apparently. The film also features Zoe Kravitz as his paramedic girlfriend, Mass Smith as a British punk neighbor, and Regina King as a sympathetic detective. Liev Schreiber and Vincent D'Onofrio play Hasidic henchmen with a cameo from Bad Bunny.
Quite the cast.
The script by Charlie Houston, based on his novel, offers homage to classic noir films. The review highlights the dazzlingly scruffy recreation of a not-quite-gentrified city, with callbacks to places like Kim's Video, Shea Stadium, and the bygone ban on dancing in bars.
Aronofsky, known for films like Black Swan and The Whale, delivers a propulsive, unpredictable plot, according to Smith.
And Smith suggests Butler's performance points to a career trajectory similar to Leonardo DiCaprio's. High praise.
This review celebrates a gritty, atmospheric noir style and strong character performances, highlighting Austin Butler's continued rise as a versatile and charismatic actor. Sounds intriguing.
It does.
Next, for those who appreciate fresh takes on familiar genres, we have Hell of a Summer Review, Hoary Horror Lampooned on Hulu. John Anderson reviews Hell of a Summer, a film written and directed by Finn Wolfhard and Billy Brick.
Finn Wolfhard directing from Stranger Things.
Yes. It lampoons classic horror tropes with fresh comedy, focusing on summer camp carnage.
So a horror comedy send-up. This film clearly finds new comedic angles within that well-worn horror subgenre of slasher camp films.
The article highlights Jason Hochberg, played by Fred Hechinger, a 24-year-old returning to Camp Pineway, attempting to lead the annual preseason orientation.
And then things go wrong, presumably.
Owners go missing, counselors start disappearing, classic setup. Finn Wolfhard is one of the snarky counselors. Characters start dropping quickly and humorously. Demi, an online influencer, ends up in blood. Miley, the vegan, loses her head in the fridge. Ari, with food allergies, is eviscerated with a knife dipped in peanut butter.
Okay, so it's leaning into the absurdity. Most executions are off camera, though. The review praises the cinematography, the vintage soundtrack featuring artists like Stephen Sondheim and Eric Burdon and the Animals.
And Jason Bateman is a producer.
Interesting. It streams Friday on Hulu.
Yeah.
This offers you a recommendation for engaging new content and explores creative approaches to entertainment, reflecting on cultural trends in horror comedy.
A horror movie that's actually funny and smart, lampooning all those classic tropes. It's a great example of how creators can find fresh perspectives in familiar genres. Now let's turn to a compelling documentary, Driver Review, A Woman Seeking Solitude on 18 Wheels.
Okay, a documentary.
John Anderson reviews Nissa Azimi's debut feature documentary, Driver, which focuses on a woman seeking solitude as a truck driver, exploring her hardscrabble life, and the challenges faced by women in the industry.
This film raises an important question about storytelling and representation, giving voice to those who often go unheard. But it also highlights the tension between a purist approach, maybe letting the subject speak entirely for themselves, and the need for broader context. It's about uncovering the realities behind unseen lives.
The film relies heavily on its protagonist, Mrs. Wood, and her colleagues to tell their stories without narration or titles.
So a very observational style?
Yes. Mrs. Wood is seen negotiating a tricky turn, flipping off honking cars, and eloquently defending her career choices, along with her crusade for safer conditions for women drivers, citing sexual harassment and assault as major concerns.
That's a critical issue in that industry.
The documentary highlights the solitary nature of the road with beautiful landscape shots. However, the review notes some narrative potholes due to a lack of specific detail on the conditions or reforms being advocated.
So maybe leaving the viewer wanting more context.
Potentially. It also features a sequence where Mrs. Wood confronts a company trying to repossess her truck, claiming their business plan is based on ignoring payments and seizing vehicles. The film premieres Monday at 10 p.m. on PBS.
It offers you a glimpse into a unique subculture, promotes empathy, and highlights issues of gender and labor rights relevant to a diverse workforce. Sounds powerful.
It does. Lastly, for some Broadway humor with a poignant twist, we have Jeff Ross, Take a Banana for the Writer View, the Roastmaster on Broadway.
Ah, Jeff Ross, the Roastmaster General himself, on Broadway.
Yes. Charles Isherwood reviews his solo show, describing it as an autobiographical and bitingly funny performance where Rose softens his image by roasting himself and sharing poignant life experiences.
That's quite a turn. This is a remarkable evolution for a comedian known primarily for insult humor, now turning that sharp wit inward to explore deeper autobiographical themes with vulnerability and humor.
It makes you consider how personal pain and resilience shape the art of comedy, right? And what universal truths we can find in an individual's journey through loss and healing.
Absolutely. So the 90-minute show, directed by Stephen Kessler, is mostly self-roasting with some audience interaction.
Where Ross descends to playfully insult volunteers and gives them bananas. Classic Ross.
Right. Ross, clad in a glittery yellow suit, chronicles his life from a middle-class Newark upbringing and his Jewish heritage, joking it led to the invention of Barbie, teddy bears, and roasts.
But it gets darker.
Yes. The show also delves into darker elements. His mother diagnosed with leukemia when he was 12. His father became a cocaine addict, leaving him and his sister parentless. He reflects on the difficulty of getting close to people after such hits and also shares his own battle with colon cancer.
Wow, that's heavy stuff for a comedy show.
It is. There's apparently a poignant photo shown with deceased comedian friends like Gilbert Gottfried, Norm Macdonald, and Bob Saget, underscoring the theme of loss. However, there are heartwarming passages, too. His relationship with his grandfather, Pop Jack, who gave the show its title advice.
Take a banana for the ride.
Right. And his unexpected journey adopting an elderly German shepherd named Nana during the pandemic, despite initially being a non-dog person. The show ends with an adorable dog co-star.
Jeff Ross, the Roastmaster General, turning the spotlight on himself and delving into deeply personal, even tragic moments is truly compelling. It's a powerful reminder that behind every laugh, there's often a story of resilience and healing.
It really sounds like it.
This offers you a window into the creative process of comedy, explores themes of coping with loss and adversity, and provides insights into a unique Broadway experience. Okay, to conclude our deep dive today, let's explore some fascinating lifestyle and real estate stories, starting with unique homes and renovations. First up, what a $1.5 million renovation of a 285-year-old Nantucket home looks like.
Nantucket, historic. Expensive renovation. Checks all the boxes.
Pretty much. This article details how Whitney Lux and Carl Schneider undertook a painstaking $1.5 million restoration of their 285-year-old Nantucket home. Their focus was on honoring its history by restoring original features while simultaneously modernizing it for contemporary living.
This project beautifully illustrates that dedication to authenticity and the deep dive into a home's layered history. It makes you consider, what's the true value of preserving architectural heritage, and how does it intersect with modern living? It's truly a deep dive into a home's past, isn't it?
It really is. The house on Main Street in the historic downtown was originally built in the 1740s by a mariner named John Barnard. The project was managed by an architectural conservator, Penn Austin, who'd previously restored Mount Vernon.
So, serious expertise involved. What did they do?
They transformed a damp, dirt floor basement into a light-filled family space, adding a vapor membrane underpinning the foundation for more ceiling height, and they unearthed a 30-foot well.
A well? Wow. What did they do with it?
Covered it with tempered glass. Very cool feature. They restored hearths, repurposed wood, grain painted where original paint couldn't be removed, flipped the dining room and kitchen on the main level to expose colonial-era timber framing.
Sounds incredibly detailed.
Added push-button light switches, expanded the kitchen with a wall of windows featuring period glass panes. In the attic, they found three layers of flooring and chose to restore the oldest from the 1800s. Meticulously rebuilt stairs.
And interestingly, they opted against air conditioning.
Yes, to preserve the home's original nooks and architectural integrity.
That's commitment.
This certainly inspires those interested in home renovation and historical preservation, offering practical insights into the challenges and rewards of such complex projects. It beautifully demonstrates that balance between honoring historical integrity and creating a functional modern living space, highlighting the complexity, cost, and unexpected discoveries involved.
A labor of love, clearly.
Another impressive renovation story is from a $2 million renovation gave their historic home new life. Elizabeth and Michael Brown invested over $2 million in renovating their circa 1840s Gothic Revival-style country manor in New York's Hudson Valley.
Another huge renovation.
They expanded it to create a bigger kitchen and primary suite, all while carefully preserving its historic feel.
What's particularly impressive here is that seamless integration of a significant modern expansion into a historic structure, designing it to look as if it thoughtfully evolved over centuries, that takes skill. How do you add substantial new space while respecting and enhancing the original character?
The Browns searched for 3 years before finding the Peary Homestead in Germantown, New York, which they bought for $1.2 million in 2019. They moved in full-time during the pandemic.
And the original house needed work.
Oh, yeah. The kitchen was a challenging trapezoid shape. There was a giant pizza oven in the dining room, a 1980s hot tub in the primary bathroom.
Okay, definitely needed an update.
Their architect suggested a holistic approach, leading to an 1,800-square-foot addition for a new kitchen and primary suite. Absolutely. This provides insights into the luxury real estate market, complex renovations, and how personal life changes can influence major property decisions.
Life happens.
From historic manors to ultra-luxury, let's look at Ailey Tahari, co-founder, lists European-inspired New Jersey home for $24.75 million.
Okay, now we're talking serious money. Abraham Tahari, co-founder of the fashion brand Ailey Tahari.
Yes, listing his roughly 21,000-square-foot European-inspired home in Alpine, New Jersey, for a cool $24.75 million.
Alpine, known for its huge estates. This listing brings up an interesting intersection of luxury, personal taste, and market valuation in high-end real estate. More broadly, it reflects how deeply personal vision can translate into a tangible, multi-million-dollar asset.
This gated 2-acre property is currently tied for Alpine's most expensive home for sale, built around 2016. Tahari designed the backyard landscape to remind him of the south of France, aiming for a European look.
He bought the land 15 years ago for $4.25 million and finished the previous owner's foundation. What are the features?
8 bedrooms, a mosaic-tiled indoor pool, an outdoor pool with cabanas. The walls were hand-plastered and stenciled by an artist from Portugal. Murano chandelier in the primary bath.
Sounds opulent.
The property has hosted numerous parties and fashion shoots, showcasing its blend of personal style and entertainment value. This offers you a glimpse into ultra-luxury real estate, design trends, and the market dynamics at the highest price points.
A different world.
Now, for an estate with quite a celebrity pedigree, a Connecticut estate once owned by Mike Tyson and 50 Cent hits the market.
Tyson and 50 Cent? That house must have some stories.
You'd imagine. This massive 51,000-square-foot Connecticut estate has hit the market for $9.9 million. It's absolutely stuffed with amenities, including a nightclub, a recording studio, and a casino.
51,000 square feet. A property's history, especially celebrity ownership, can certainly add to its unique appeal and market positioning. Who owns it now?
The current owners, the Askers, invested over $3 million in renovating the circa 1985 house. They added a cigar lounge, upgraded the commercial kitchen with a pizza oven and dough mixer.
So they put their own stamp on it too.
Definitely. They redid the indoor pool and spa steam room, red light therapy sauna, massage area, hair salon. The nightclub, called Club TKO, a reference to Tyson's boxing career, was installed by Tyson himself.
Club TKO. Perfect.
The current owners use it for parties and corporate retreats. The estate also features multiple game rooms, sports courts, an outdoor pool, a movie theater, even a green screen room.
It's basically a private resort. Why are they selling?
Their children are grown. The asking price is nearly double the most expensive sale ever recorded in Hartford County, highlighting its unique position in the market.
Accessible via helicopter, I bet.
It mentions that, yes, to New York and Boston.
From Mike Tyson's Club TKO to a recording studio. It's incredible to see how these properties reflect the lifestyles of their past and present owners.
This offers you fascination with celebrity homes, helps you understand unique luxury market segments, and the impact of amenities on property value.
Wild stuff.
Finally, in renovations, they were over budget and behind schedule, but the renovation was just right. This is a relatable story for many.
The classic renovation experience.
Anjali and Naveed Khayyam, first-time renovators in London, spent twice their expected budget, $1.89 million, and took 2 years to renovate their Victorian fixer-upper. But they infused elements of their Sri Lankan heritage and uniquely embraced existing defects as design features.
That's interesting. This story explores the true cost of transforming a vision into reality. More broadly, it's a testament to perseverance, creativity, and the power of embracing imperfections to create something truly unique and meaningful.
The Khayyams bought their 1890 three-story house in Putney, London for $3.2 million in 2020. What was initially expected to be a six-month project ballooned to 2 years and double the budget.
Why the delay and cost overrun?
Significant changes, including adding a new basement level after discovering deep tree roots required underpinning. They also added a first floor addition and an open plan principal suite.
So major structural work.
Yes. But rather than erasing flaws, they preserved sections of plasterwork as design features and infused their home with elements from Sri Lanka paintings, carvings, brass ornaments, rattan furniture. Their top floor principal suite even evokes Japan with screens and a sunken wood bathtub.
So a very personal and eclectic mix.
Anjali's favorite is a library room with bespoke shelving and Sri Lankan masks. Interestingly, many visitors thought they were still working due to the exposed walls, but the couple appreciated the ruggedness.
I like that, owning the imperfections.
This provides you relatable insights into home renovation challenges, inspires creative design, and explores how personal history and culture can be integrated into living spaces. It highlights the common challenges of budget overruns and schedule delays, but also the deep personalization and integration of cultural heritage.
A great story to end the renovation section. #tag real estate market trends.
Okay, let's round out real estate with some interesting market trends. First, buyers are test driving homes with sleepovers.
Wait, sleepovers? Like before you buy?
Exactly. This article highlights a growing trend in the real estate market where prospective buyers are asking to test drive homes with overnight stays before making offers, especially for high value properties. The goal, naturally, is to ensure comfort and suitability.
That's fascinating. This trend shows how the real estate market is adapting to buyer demands for more experiential due diligence. It makes you consider what this trend signifies about the changing expectations of home buyers and how it might reshape traditional real estate practices in the future.
The article provides several anecdotes. Eric Albert allowed an overseas couple to stay for 2 months at $250,000 per month in his $60 million Newport Coast estate.
$250,000 a month. Did they buy it?
No, they loved it but didn't buy. Another agent's client got a free overnight stay in a $14.6 million Hollywood Hills spec home, only to realize he wanted a smaller space.
So it can actually prevent a bad purchase.
It seems so. Another agent's client stayed free in a $600,000 Hudson Valley home, testing utilities and experiencing the nighttime sounds, and then bought it.
So it can work both ways. While ultra-wealthy buyers have requested this for years, it's becoming more common now.
Apparently. However, some agents find it strange. Jade Mills recalled an 8-hour chaos of a dinner that involved a fire alarm and a buyer taking a shower.
Okay, maybe not always smooth.
And others, like one buyer mentioned, are willing to pay a premium to rent a property for 3 months before buying, believing a short stay isn't enough to get the vibe.
Imagine sleeping over in your dream home before you buy it. It's such a personal decision, and this trend really highlights how much buyers want to get it right. So, what does this all mean for the traditional real estate process?
It shows an evolving buying process that offers benefits for buyers, like a deep understanding of the property, and for sellers, like premium fees and serious buyers. But it also carries risks, liability, potential property damage, privacy concerns.
A lot to navigate there.
This offers you a fascinating look at evolving real estate practices, influencing how you might approach future home purchases or sales, and the ethical and practical considerations involved.
Definitely something new.
Finally, for some truly unusual real estate stories, we have when the listing appointment ends with a tour of an underground Y2K bunker.
Oh, secret bunkers. Always fun.
This article features real estate professionals sharing their encounters with secret rooms and bunkers and homes, Y2K bunkers, Cold War vaults, even lavish speakeasies highlighting unique property features and unexpected seller revelations.
This article makes you consider the stories hidden within our homes, doesn't it? And what those spaces tell us about the fears and desires of their creators. More broadly, it's about how personal anxieties and passions can manifest in surprising architectural forms.
Renee Roberts, a broker in Massachusetts, described listing a home with two hidden soundproof concrete Y2K bunkers.
Built by someone fearing the Y2K bug.
Wow.
Complete with electrical outlets and air exchange systems. She recounted a chilling moment when the owner closed the bank vault-style door on her to demonstrate its soundproofing.
Yikes.
Greg Mazur, another Massachusetts agent, listed a home with a 7,200-square-foot climate-controlled underground vault designed by the Army Corps of Engineers during the Cold War for banks fearing a nuclear attack on Boston.
A Cold War bank vault under a house. What was it used for later?
Wine storage, then a mushroom farm.
Of course.
And Scott Baines, an agent in Aspen, listed a $15.95 million property featuring a smuggler-den speakeasy below a three-car garage.
Accessed via a hydraulic door or hidden stairway.
Yes. Complete with a lounge, bar, LED lights, fireplace, TV, sound system, photo booth, and a reverse car lift that displays a collector vehicle behind glass.
Designed by a chain restaurant founder for entertaining. Makes sense.
These unique property features can certainly be highly specific selling points, attracting niche buyers. And they certainly reveal seller motivations, from paranoia to passion for entertaining.
These entertaining anecdotes from the real estate world spark your curiosity about hidden spaces and reflect on how personal histories are embedded in homes.
Absolutely fascinating glimpses behind closed doors. Hashtag tag, 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 sex from corrections and amplifications.
Okay.
And finally, we always like to acknowledge the corrections and amplifications section. It's a reminder that even the most meticulous reporting sometimes needs a second look.
Important for transparency.
Today, we saw clarifications on NVIDIA's revenue capture projections and Mid-Atlantic factory activity data. Specifically, NVIDIA CEO Jensen Huang's statement on AI companies spending $3 to $4 trillion during the next 5 years was clarified.
To state that NVIDIA could capture as much as 70% of that revenue, not 35% as previously reported, that's a big difference.
It is. Additionally, factory activity in the Mid-Atlantic region actually contracted in August, but less sharply than in July, correcting a Wednesday headline that incorrectly stated activity improved.
Good to get those details right. Hashtag, hashtag, outro.
Well, what a comprehensive deep dive into the Wall Street Journal for Friday, August 29th, 2025.
It really covered a lot of ground.
From the unprecedented legal battles shaping U.S. political and economic institutions, to the shifting sands of global geopolitics, the innovative and sometimes challenging future of business and technology, and those fascinating stories woven into our cultural fabric and even our homes. It's been a truly insightful journey. Thank you for guiding us through this.
My pleasure. Today's deep dive really underscored how interconnected everything is, didn't it?
It really did.
The tariffs impacting your household staples are linked to global trade wars, which in turn affect central bank decisions and even the strategic alliances between nations. And those individual stories of innovation or personal struggle, whether it's in waste management or on Broadway, they often reflect deeper societal currents. It encourages all of us to look beyond the headlines and truly see the web of connections.
Absolutely. So, as you go about your day, maybe consider this. In a world where unprecedented political challenges are testing the very independence of our institutions, and the promise of a truly hassle-free future is simultaneously offering self-driving trash bins and raising questions about how we'll even earn an income in the age of AI, what foundational principles do you believe are most crucial to protect and innovate for the next generation?
A good question to ponder.
That's all for today's deep dive. We hope this has given you a richer, more informed perspective on the world. Until next time, keep digging deeper.